Okay, so whoever's talking, we need to mute them.
Okay, so
Samsung.
Because whoever's on the Samsung, we're gonna mute you.
Mute everybody here.
Whoops, you just
unmuted. Oh, they're the wrong one.
Okay, so muted everybody except Lisa, right? Is that us?
Let me bring this down here.
I need to unmute Christina.
And they're able to unmute themselves.
They are?
They are.
Okay.
When I need to talk.
Oh, yes, we'll make sure that you're unmuted. Are we still muted?
No. We should not be. No, we're not.
Okay.
Okay, so Tony's on.
As far as I can tell, we need one more for a quorum, Ryan. Oh, you unmute, Ryan. Oh, he was right there. There he is.
This is Carl Bob. I think we have six here.
Yeah, we should have Bob.
I've got Carl. I don't have Vicky, Jim Newberry. Oh, Greg's here. Jordan or Will?
Jordan's right there.
Jordan's here.
I've got Jordan. Oh, I've got Jordan. Okay, excellent.
I am here as well.
All right. Hi, Will. So oh, he's the Samsung.
No one else is giving their name.
We'll just get rid of this.
There you go. Okay.
So it looks like we're just missing Vicky Malloy and Jim Newberry.
No, Vicky's right. Well, there's a Vicky right there. Under Tiffany.
Yeah, will you unmute that one so I can. Vicky?
She went away.
Oh.
Yeah, she left.
Hopefully she comes back.
Are you ready to start recording now at 7? Or, well, I guess you don't have, did you say that?
To the.
And then to the computer. Right there.
Hey, Vicky.
Scott?
Oh, there's the inheritance.
Hello, Ryan.
Hello.
I think your friend is trying to get.
Okay, Ryan, you have a quorum anytime you're ready.
I am ready. Thank you for everyone who's attending. Call this meeting to order. Good evening all. Today is Wednesday, April 22nd, 2020. I'd like to call the Planning Commission meeting to order. I would like to note that due to the Governor Proclamation 20-28, the Planning Commission will hold the regularly scheduled meetings via Zoom video conference until further notice. Please note that this is a Zoom meeting. Your mics are all automatically muted, controlled by the meeting coordinator. Background noise is amplified and makes it very hard for others to hear when people are speaking. When you wish to speak, click the raise hand in the webinar controls. Looks like a little blue hand. It's one of your options is a raise hand, a yes and a no. But if you click the raise hand, it'll make the facilitators aware that you'd like to talk or ask a question. And then let's go through the roll call real quick. Vicki Malloy. Say yes again.
Just unmute everybody right here. Unmute all. Hold on a second. Okay, everyone is unmuted now.
Vicki Malloy.
Vicki is here.
Will Riggs.
I'm here.
I would mute him.
Ryan Kelso is here. Jim Newberry.
Because you're getting like there.
No one, Jim. Randy Baldwin. Jordan. David. Carl Blow.
Here.
Pat Hammersmith.
Here.
And Greg Becker.
Here.
Now mute them all.
Yeah, you're bored up.
This is Greg Becker. Can I get a clarification? I don't have.
Oops. hold on. I don't know which number is his. Unmute everybody again.
881.
This is...
It ends in 4766.
Got it. Thank you. I'm sorry, Greg Becker, go ahead.
Okay, I do not have, I'm calling from my cell phone, so I don't have a little hand if I want to, make a point or address the commission. So what do I do?
We're actually going to unmute all of the Planning Commission members during the entire meeting. So you should be able to speak up.
Okay, thank you.
So how would I unmute Wiggs? Because it doesn't give me the option.
Newberry is now here.
They might not have the right connections. They might not be able to speak.
Oh, okay.
You're muted.
Yeah. Actually, the Planning Commission members can unmute yourselves. There you go.
Item number two, administrative. There's a item number two on the agenda, which is review approval of minutes of March 25th, 2020. Have all the Planning Commission members that were in attendance review those minutes, and if so, make a motion.
Before the motion, can I ask a question, Greg Becker?
Sure.
Okay, I might be having a senior moment, but it says in here that we voted at the last meeting to approve the text amendments to the county code flood hazard development. Did we vote to approve the text, the amendments to the text before we even discussed them?
No, you did not.
My recollection is we voted to continue the hearing today.
That is...
Right. But this says we voted unanimously to approve the text amendment.
Yes, we need to correct the minutes. That is incorrect. It was postponed to a date and time certain, which would be tonight.
So I'm not having a senior moment.
You are not.
Not tonight.
Oh, okay, good. Thanks a lot.
So the motion will need to include a correction to the minutes.
This is Board Member Devitt. I move to approve the minutes with the correction that we did not vote to approve the text amendments to the flood hazard code. We voted to continue it to a date and time certain, being this meeting on April 22nd at 7 p.m.
Second.
Who seconded?
Jim. Great second. Thank you, Jim.
And Jim did? Was that Jim? Okay.
Hey.
I need to vote. And the vote?
And the vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Are there any nays? Motion approves. Meetings are, meeting agenda, or meeting minutes from this past. March meeting approved. I have a note here that Lynn sent me a thing that is a note here that you're asking. Move on.
Okay.
Item number three, public comment period. So at the beginning of each meeting here, we'll open the floor for public comment that's not identified on the agenda. Please note each person is limited to 3 minutes for any topic or item you wish to bring up. We do have quite a few people that have called in and are watching via video feed. If you have a question and would like to talk, please click the raise hand on the side menu. You are able to, if you have a question.
We don't see anything.
Nothing's happening there?
And we don't see anybody's hands.
Okay. Well, if we will take that as a no. So we will move on to old business. We'll now open the hearing for text amendments to Chelan County Code Chapter 3.20 Flood Hazard Development.
Can I hold on a second, Ryan? I'm sorry. Dina Walter with Community Development. Can we, before you proceed with that, if there's anybody on for the text amendments, it's
CT.
Under new business, it's the new, I don't have the agenda.
Yes, under new business, hearing for ZTA 2020-05 limited text amendments.
Yes.
That item, we were asking and would like to actually move it for a new time, preferably in 2 weeks, to review together as a planning commission if we have an agreement in it to help reduce the length of tonight's meeting.
This is Carl Blum for the staff. Whenever we do have this hearing, I would ask that the staff report be redone to correct the errors that are in it. The staff report indicates it's for short-term vacation rentals, and it says that in the body, and of course that's not what it's for.
Correct. I will make sure that that is corrected. You also will be receiving a bullet point summary, kind of a Cliff Notes version, because there's a lot of text in there. So the proposed date would be a special meeting on May 6th at 6 p.m.
Is there a motion from anyone on the Planning Commission to?
Would that be 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock?
6 p.m. preferred.
6 p.m., okay.
That would be a change in time, because we've been meeting at 7 in the summer, so I'm fine with either, but I think we're advertising 7.
We had made an agreement that we could go 6 in the wintertime and then 7 when there's more light out, so for those of us that are beating our heads against the wall trying to keep things going, we're coming.
Staff has no preference, so.
So are we?
Okay, I would make a motion that we continue the hearing, or we move the hearing for ZTA 2020-05 to May 6th at 7 p.m.
7.
Second. Great, Becker.
Thank you.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any nays? Motion carries. Hearing for ZTA 2020-05, limited text amendments will be moved to 7 p.m. on May 2nd.
6.
6.
Excuse me, 6.
May 6th.
Okay.
All right, we'll move back to old business. So we'll now open the hearing for text amendments to Chelan County Code Chapter 3.20 Flood Hazard Development. Turn it back to staff.
And this is Christina.
You just want me to start?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. So I'm Christina Woolman, I'm with Pertee, and I have been working with Chelan County for about the past 4 years with the Flood Control Zone District. And recently I have been working with the Community Development Department to work on an update to the Flood Hazard Development Code. And I'd like to give you a little bit of background on this. We started this update quite a while ago, not quite a while ago, but many, many months ago, working on an update. And then we were told by FEMA that we have to do more updates to the code. So this is a combination of requirements from FEMA to update the code, as well as basic code updates for clarity, consistency, and to just update the code, codify provisions that are already required. The reason that we have this code is because Chelan County is part of the National Flood Insurance Program. In order for landowners to be able to purchase flood insurance, the county must be part of the National Flood Insurance Program. And in order for the county to be in that program, they have to agree to regulate the floodplain according to FEMA basic regulations. There's also state regulations that the county must follow. Every few years, either the Department of Ecology or FEMA comes and visits the community. They call it a community assistance visit, or CAP. And Ecology came to the county in 2015 for a CAP, and there was also a code update at that time. Recently, FEMA came to the county for a CAP. Last year, I think in July, was our meeting, and have identified additional code updates that are required. And so I'm just going to go briefly through the code updates and point out some of the more important components of the update. And I recognize floodplain regulations are complicated, and there's terminology that goes along with it. So if you have any questions about anything I'm talking about or any of the terminology that I use, please stop me and I'll explain further. And I'm going to just go in order, starting at the beginning of the code. If I reference a section, it'll be referenced to the new code, to the new number, the proposed number. And these updates are based on the code of federal regulations and the Washington State WACs that regulate floodplain development. We base the language off of the Washington State Model Floodplain Ordinance. And some major updates of the code include section 040 or 040 exemptions. We clarified the exemptions and added additional exemptions for projects that are not considered development. Development has a very broad definition according to FEMA, and so this really helps with identifying the types of projects that people do not need to get a flood permit for. If the project is not listed on here, it's highly likely that a flood permit is required. In section 120, for definitions, we added several definitions to code. These are all based off of the definitions in the Code of Federal Regulations. In section 140, we added a process for determining, or for when the 100-year floodplain boundary is in question, we added a process. This is a process that we already use, so this is just codifying the process and making it more apparent to people who are developing in the floodplain. When they read the code, they have a better understanding. Section 150 is about information to be submitted with the flood permit. This was updated to be more consistent with the state and federal requirements, as well as providing better clarity for applicants. This should help with the application process. When people read this section of code, they'll have a better understanding of what they need to submit to the county. The next few sections were just updates, basic updates, for consistency with the state and federal regulations, until section 240. Which is about construction materials and methods. In this section, we will require that building utilities, like water heaters, furnaces, air conditioners, that they all be elevated to the same elevation as the lowest floor of the structure. This really helps with flood insurance premiums. It will reduce flood insurance premiums for homeowners for a very small, insignificant change to the project. Section 260 is about construction activity, so the construction of residential and non-residential structures. For residential construction, we clarified requirements for attached garages on structures. There was not any guidance in the current code for how to construct an attached garage in the floodplain. And this is when the garage floor is at a lower level below the base flood elevation. We also added some clarification for below grade crawl spaces, which was also not in code. And it has very specific requirements that are required to be in code if they're allowed in your community. And so now this will be added in code, and it will be an option in some cases for people if they want to low grade crawlspaces. For non-residential construction, we just clarified the requirements. And then we added a new section for accessory structures like detached garages, storage sheds. There is currently not a provision in Schlein County Code for accessory structures in the floodplain. Per the current code, these structures have to be built as a non-residential structure, which is a much higher standard than what they need to be built at. This new provision allows for a reduced construction standard for certain structures that can comply with the guidance. So, some of that guidance is the accessory structure can only be for parking or storage, has to be built with flood resistant materials, and we may have to have flow-through vents to allow floodwaters to flow through the structure when there's flood. In section 270, is about grading and filling, and we just updated this to provide more clarity to the requirements. The current code uses some language that is very vague and difficult to enforce. And then section 300 is about the floodway. The floodway is the most restricted part of the 130-year floodplain, and for many reasons. One reason is because it's the most dangerous part of the floodplain. It's where water will flow most rapidly, but it's also the area that has to be preserved to allow water to continue flowing. Otherwise, you'll increase flooding on adjacent properties. And so we clarify these requirements. Updated the language to be more consistent with the state's requirements. And then we added in some provisions that allow for residential construction in the floodway in very, very limited circumstances. Currently, residential construction per Washington State WACS is not allowed in the floodway. And so this allows certain situations for replacement of damaged structures in the floodway. Does not allow new structures. We also allowed a provision for fish enhancement structures in the floodway. This was at the request of the Natural Resources Department because FEMA Region 10, which is where we're located here, they issued a policy to allow a slightly reduced standard for fish enhancement structures in the floodway. And so by putting this in code, we're just making sure that people are aware of it and noting that the county is willing to follow this policy. And then section 330 is about development proposals. The big change here was a change. So this referred to all development instead of just subdivisions. Some of this language came from the Critical Areas Ordinance, which is also being updated at the same time. And so we've taken the language from the Critical Areas Ordinance and put it in here, just so we can keep things consistent. And then the last section that I want to point out is the variance procedures. And there wasn't really any substance changes in this section. It was just changing the language to be more consistent with the state's model ordinance. And those are all the changes that I wanted to point out to you. Happy to answer any questions.
This is Greg Becker. I have a question on the flooding on page 6. And in paragraph 1A, it refers to tidal waters, and in paragraph 2, it refers to tidal waters. Is that really applicable to Chelan County? Does the tidal waters obviously may fit other parts of the state, but doesn't fit us? Should that not be removed?
You're right, it doesn't apply to Chelan County, but it is the FEMA definition of flood. And so it's easiest to just put in the FEMA definition, and we know we don't have tidal waters here, so that it just doesn't apply.
And my next question then is on page 7, refers to ship building and ship repair. Are we talking the same thing? We may have boat building and boat repair, but we certainly don't have ship repair.
That's the same thing.
Okay.
It's a FEMA definition. I would assume that ship and boat could be used interchangeably.
Well, there's probably a significant difference, but if we're stuck with the Fed's language, then we're stuck with the Fed's language. I noticed on farmhouses, on page 18, replacement of farmhouses in the floodway, it says, repairs or improvements shall not increase the total square footage of the encroachment of the existing farmhouse. Are we talking about the footprint or the actual square footage of the house?
It's the...
That cannot be improved.
The footprint of the house.
So should that not be clarified that we're not talking about just the square footage, but we're talking about the total structure, but we're talking strictly if the footprint can't increase, then I would assume what we're saying, if it was a single level dwelling, it could be increased to a double level dwelling as long as the footprint is not increased. Is that correct?
Could possibly. There are provisions in the floodway regulations that may prohibit that on residential structures. And so I'm skimming through that, trying to find.
Okay, page 18, says A, replacement of farmhouse, number 3, repairs, construction, or improvements to a farmhouse shall not increase the total square footage of encroachment of the existing farmhouse. So again, my question is, are we talking the footprint or the actual square footage?
So this language is based off of state WAC, and so I'm not sure, but generally when it comes to residential improvements in the floodplain, so if you're not in a farmhouse, this farmhouse one is for what is called substantially damaged. So substantially damaged is when the repairs to your structure cost more than 50% of the value of the structure. So any structure in the floodway, if it has a kitchen fire or a tree falls on it or any sort of repair that's required, if it is more than 50%, if it costs more than 50% to repair the structure, it cannot be repaired. The same goes with renovations. So if you have a structure in the floodway, an existing structure, and you want to put a second floor on it, that's okay because you're not increasing the footprint of the structure, but you can only put that second floor on if that improvement costs less than 50% of the value of the structure. So it's the floodway regulations are pretty clear in most cases on this footprint issue, and so I would think that C, that or with the provision that you're pointing out there, would be related to the footprint as well.
As someone that works with that quite a bit, I'd like to actually see verbiage that states that as part of that.
I agree.
Okay, we can check into that because there may be something with the square footage where they don't want the house to become bigger than it was before. You know, so they don't want to take a one-story house and let you replace it with a two-story house. So we can clarify that.
Because with the footprint, is based on restrictions for flow more so than anything?
No.
Do I need to unmute Dave Spencer?
Sorry,
yeah. Well, can you make a note, can you do yourself and look at page 23 as well, where it says violations and fines, it talks about enlarge. So it seems to me that may require some clarification too, because some people may deem if you add a second story at an enlargement, even though you have not increased the footprint. So those kind of go hand in hand.
Ryan, Dave, you can't see it, but Dave Spencer has his hand up. Well, you may not be able to see it.
I don't see anything.
Oh, Dave Spencer, the building official, has his hand up.
All right, I just want to unmute Dave. Question.
Oh, hold on, Dave. I think you need to unmute from your end. Where is he?
You might need to turn on your microphone.
Unfortunately, the list doesn't come up in alphabetical order, so.
He's unmuted.
He's unmuted. Okay.
Yeah.
He could call in on the phone line.
Yes.
Good morning, Sue. This is Carl Plum. On what you're talking about there, what Greg was talking about, it said the square footage of encroachment, and I guess that, to me, that kind of means the footprint. That's a fancy way of saying footprint, but I'm not sure. I agree with you. Clarify.
That's correct, because an encroachment is how far into the floodway you are. And so the square footage of the encroachment would only be related to the footprint. But again, this is based on the WAC, so we'll have to double check and make sure. And because if it's the same language that's in the WAC, then we probably just want to keep it the same. An additional, if you read that section, the Department of Ecology has to approve that that reconstruction of the farmhouse, so it's not just the county's decision.
Yeah, just verify that with the WAC. Appreciate it.
I notice on page 23, this is Greg again, and under the very bottom of the page, it talks about variances. I would assume that there is a fee attached with an application for a variance. Does that go by the county fee schedule, or is there a separate fee schedule as it relates to flood hazard and development?
We've never talked about the fee for a variance. Quite possibly there has never been a variance, one of these variances issued in the county. They're very, very rare. So I would have to defer that to either. That's a good question.
Yes, and we do need to address it in the fee schedule. I can't say for certain right now, but it makes sense that it would fall along the same lines as any of the regular variances, a riparian variance, a flood variance, a shoreline variance, just a standard variance. So it will fall into the same category and go through the same process. We haven't discussed the fee associated with it, though, but we will look at that.
Any other questions once the Planning Commission? See that David's hand is still up and still no voice or sound.
David, do you want the number to call in here? Oh, he's on his phone, so he can't.
Yeah, he sent me a text, but I don't understand what he meant.
We're in uncharted territory here.
I think he had some typos, maybe.
Okay, he said move on.
All right.
Yeah, I was wondering if he could use the chat function to make a statement or
yes.
Or ask a question.
He should be able to.
So do I hit on chat?
No, you'll see it pop up.
Oh, it says that there's four on there though.
So I can hit that chat and it'll bring up the chat. I'm sorry, yeah, I didn't. We can join meeting. There was a question in the chat also from a Cheryl Nelson. Can we use the chat to ask questions? And we'll keep the chat up, and as questions come up, we can relay them to Ryan Kelso. So, yes.
you have a question that popped up on your end?
No, but I saw, there we go. Okay, so David Spencer said, look at the last sentence, number 2 on page 16, that says 50%. I'm not sure what.
Perhaps they're talking about fees. Oh, no. That's a footprint, I think.
Yeah.
So this sentence is saying when you're calculating the cost of the project, that if the existing structure had violations or sections of the structure that really needed to be improved for health and safety reasons, you can exclude that from that 50% calculation.
Okay. And there's a question from Cheryl Nelson. It concerns, I'm assuming she's concerned that if someone loses their home that they cannot rebuild. It's a question. Oh, does it concern anyone that if someone loses their home, they cannot rebuild?
It is very concerning for any homeowner that has a structure in the floodway, that if you have an accident involving your house and it costs more than 50%, that your house has to be torn down. That is very concerning. It's very difficult when that situation happens, which is why there's no new structures allowed in the floodway. So this is only existing structures. The idea is to keep anything new out of the floodway, and hope that nothing ever substantial happens to your structure. All the structures that are in the floodway now should have been built prior to 1981 when this flood ordinance went into effect.
Any other questions from the public or amongst the Planning Commission?
Well, I was curious if there's going to be a time for public testimony. I was hoping there would be some comment.
Open it up to public at the moment. So if there is anyone in the public that has questions regarding the flood hazard development portion.
Yes, Dan Beardley put his hand up.
Am I good to go online?
Yeah, I can hear you. Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. I didn't see the little hands you're referring to on the console, so I just raised my I would like to talk about section 3.20.330, subparagraph 5, it starts for land divisions.
Can you list that again, Dan? List that section
sorry,
again.
3.20.3305.
Dan, what page is that on?
21. Page 21. So what I'm referring to is that it says for land divisions and boundary line adjustments, a designated buildable area in each lot shall be provided, et cetera, et cetera, and identified in the face of final plat, certified surveyor, mining site plan. First of all, boundary line adjustments are an exempt activity, and they often have nothing to do with identifying buildable areas. That sometimes you're just moving line a couple of feet one way or the other. It may not even be a buildable area, and you can still do a boundary adjustment. So this, and there is no requirement for a final plat, short plat, survey, or mining site plan, Mylar. Those things don't happen with a boundary adjustment. So I would suggest that you strike and boundary line adjustments from that, because it would be impossible for any citizen to ever figure out that they need to go look at the floodplain ordinance to do a simple boundary line adjustment.
This is Jordan McDevitt. It makes a lot of sense to me. Christina, what would that take, or how does that sound to you?
This the section came from the critical areas ordinance, so it's currently in code right now. But I do see, I understand that when you have two lots that are entirely within the floodway, moving the line around doesn't make a difference. But if you have a lot that is currently partially outside the floodway and does have a buildable site, and then you move the line so that you create a lot without a buildable, or a lot that's not buildable, that is what this should be preventing. And I think we could change the language to clarify that it's creation of new unbuildable lots and not taking two existing lots in the floodway and just moving the line around to change things up.
Well, this applies to not only floodways, but floodplain, right?
No, this applies to floodway. It says a buildable area in each lot shall be provided for outside the floodway.
It applies to any boundary adjustment, right, in the floodplain, in the designated floodplain, whether or not it's in the floodplain, the way it reads immediately.
Yeah, so we can update that to be more clear. The intent is to not be able to create an unbuildable lot.
Yeah, that's fine, but the way it reads now, it does need to be changed in my mind. Thank you.
And what are we protecting against by not allowing someone to create an unbuildable lot?
You're protecting against someone buying that lot, unaware of the fact that it's in the floodway and it's not buildable, and then they come into the county with a full set of building plans to get a building permit to learn that they can't build.
Sure.
That's the big thing that we want to protect against, but also we just shouldn't be creating unbuildable lots in the county.
I could just see a rural recreational parcel that wasn't intended to be built on. It'd be nice if there was a way, if you were trying to do this in the right circumstances, it was allowed.
Well, there is a provision in there. It says unless the lot is designated for open space or protected by a conservation easement, because the floodway makes really good open space, and it does make sense to make, or, you know, to put that portion in open space. So that was the intent of adding that additional language, which currently isn't in code, that was added.
Okay, but I mean, you would do that as part of a cluster subdivision?
Yeah,
well,
you could.
You designate open space, I guess, a plat, but okay.
Yeah, and that's where the conservation easement or some other form of permanent protection on that lot, if you were doing a subdivision.
What if it was done due to the fact that you had two parcels that likely nothing could be built? They both had a small buildable area, but so limited in space that one property owner is giving a boundary line adjustment to the other to make something reasonably sized to build on.
Yeah, I understand that's what you're describing, but again, you're creating a buildable lot or an unbuildable lot in the floodway that has the potential to, because it happens a lot where people buy lots in the floodway without realizing that they can't build on.
At that point, could you just record something to the deed that makes note of that for purchasing?
Possibly would be, that could be a way of preserving it in open space, a form of open space.
I mean, I would also just, yeah, if you attach to the deed, if there was no buildable portion on the lot, then you're preventing that situation where someone buys it, thinking they can build, so just record it in the deed.
This is Carl Long. Is this section that we're talking about, is this, it used to say subdivision proposals, now it's changed to development proposals, but is that the intent? It's for subdivisions that we're not calling developments?
So this section was changed from subdivision to development so that it was more broad and that it wasn't specific to subdivisions. Some of the provisions in here are specific to subdivisions, some of them are not. And so this one is Kind of, because you can't really create a lot without doing subdivision, so, but the boundary line adjustments added in there as well.
I guess part of the reason I hesitate a little bit is, if I remember right, when you record a boundary line adjustment, the county specifically says they will not guarantee that it's built a lot.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that doesn't get recorded on the deed. That's just a disclaimer.
It's recorded in the boundary adjustment sequence title, part of the title.
That also is correct.
Okay.
And I
but
think
that
I,
still doesn't mean that it's not a billable lot. It's just that to tell people that they need to do their due diligence, which people may or may not do. But yeah, we can work with we can change this language if you'd like to specify what you want it to say.
I mean, I like the idea of being attached to the deed. If you create an unbuildable lot and floodway via a boundary line adjustment, it needs to be recorded. And then it can be undone that way. If you're gonna do another boundary line adjustment in the future, create a buildable lot with a different neighboring parcel, for example, it just feels like it leaves more options available.
Christina?
Okay.
Is that something that can be done through and I'm just throwing out ideas here, a notice to title that could later be extinguished?
Yeah, for a boundary line adjustment, I think that would be reasonable.
I just hazard to
division, you just shouldn't be able to create those lots.
It's hard to put something like that in a deed because we don't require deeds if it is the same owner that owns both lots. So unless there is a transfer of ownership, really no deed is required.
Yeah, just think of something that could be recorded with the lot.
Another thing too, I agree with Jordan and Ryan. It'd be nice to have something there that would throw up a red flag. Also, I use the county website all the time, and I noticed, you know, that the assessor's page got changed again the other day. And I use that flood zone part of that page all the time for mapping, and it's not on there anymore. What happened to it?
I would love to say I could fix that, but IT has decided to separate it into community development and the assessors, and so we're losing layers, and they're not connected. I'm working on getting that back together, so yeah, it is a problem, I agree.
And that's part of the due diligence, too. I mean, we do have that tool, and it's very useful in my opinion.
I do think the boundary line adjustment issue is definitely different from subdivisions. If you're creating a subdivision, the intent is to create buildable parcels. There are lots of these new boundary line adjustments that don't necessarily involve creating a home site. So it would make sense that they're different. And of course, any subdivision is going to be on the plat. I'd love to see a way to.
Okay, so we could remove boundary line adjustments from that sentence that is there now, so that would just be land divisions, and then add maybe something along the lines of boundary line adjustments that are entirely within the floodway must record a notice of title that the lot is something along those lines? Is that what you're thinking?
Or would generate an unbuildable lot?
Yeah.
Well, if it's entirely within the floodway, it's going to be an unbuildable lot.
I don't know if that gets at Dan's concern that somebody doing a boundary line adjustment isn't going to realize they need to do that.
Well, if the county would enforce it,
right,
the regulations.
Maybe that's something that gets added to the boundary line adjustment application or something. But yeah, I think that's a great solution.
Okay.
I agree.
Any other comments from public?
There is one other one from Cheryl Nelson. She asked, does FEMA decide where the, I think she meant floodplain is? And that actually does, Christina, you can answer that, but it comes from the FEMA maps.
Yeah, there's maps called flood insurance rate maps, and they identify the 100-year floodplain, which is the floodplain that is regulated, as well as the 500-year floodplain. On some water courses, there's also the floodway, which is within the 100-year floodplain. And FEMA does develop those, and the county's maps right now are pretty old in some areas of the county, and at some point in the future, FEMA will update them.
I just had a question for you. It goes back to that item we brought up earlier dealing with mechanical equipment, plumbing and stuff. We're all having to be located above the floodplain.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that you're choosing to do that because it helps save the homeowner or whoever insurance money. Is that stating as in you're stating it to try and help them, or, you know, in most cases, like, I would think that they should have the option if they want to save money that they lift it. If they don't want to save money, maybe it's not practical for locating in a different location, they should have the ability to pay a higher rate for insurance.
So if people can save $1,000 or more a year by lifting their air conditioner 1 foot off the ground or a couple feet off the ground, putting it on a platform, that's something that the county should be definitely encouraging people to do, because that is a big savings over the lifetime of a project. In addition, it is already required in the regulations that those items be above what we call the base flood elevation. That's where the water elevation will be during a 100-year flood. So you have to build your first floor above that level, that you have to put your utilities above that level. So requiring this is very low cost. It's not plumbing. It's not electric.
I did bring plumbing in there and electrical, because you do have drains and stuff that are typically served below your finished floor elevation.
So plumbing would be referring to the water heater, not the pipes, because the pipes are floodproof, obviously. Water can't get out, water can't get in. So we could change that to water heater from plumbing. But because this is defined by FEMA also, these mechanical items, and it's just a matter of lifting the your water heater, if it's in your garage, putting it on a platform. If it's in the house itself, in the closet, it doesn't matter because it's already on the floor. So it's just really related to furnaces that you might have in your garage, not water heaters, and then your air conditioners or your heat pumps that are outside. And all it requires is building a little platform and setting them up on the platform. And so it's really significant.
Could it be changed to appliances or equipment versus, because it's just, it says like electrical and plumbing?
That's what,
because that generally, I mean, you could interpret that as being an element, because at some point, typically, it's those items come in service underground in most cases.
Yeah, so electric, you know what, we should update that language. I'm seeing if I can do this really fast. To the same language that's in what's called an elevation certificate, and this is where that elevation is defined, and I'm almost there. And so it refers to elevators, which people probably aren't going to have, furnaces, hot water heaters, heat pumps, and air conditioners. So we could change it from we could change it to those those same items that are in the elevations that are described in the elevation certificate instructions. Instead of electrical heating, ventilation, plumbing, air conditioning, because that kind of repeats actually. So it's the same thing a couple times.
I prefer to see it that way, but I do think in general people should have the option if they want to pay more for insurance or not.
The other thing is people often don't get an insurance quote before they build their house for floodplain stuff. And so they don't get that until they actually have to go insure it. And so that is just something that is really easy for people to do that will save a lot of money over the life of the structure.
I understand.
That they don't recognize at the beginning of the process.
I understand. I've dealt with other structures where we've had problems creating spaces for those elements placed outside of it, you know, and it could be one of those units that's you're talking about 50% of remodeling or things that they could do, or 50% of value, and they need to keep something in a certain location or certain area, but it has to be touched. So if you touch it, then everything has to be brought up to that standard. So I've been through this before on other projects in other jurisdictions, and
So the
flexibility.
It's your choice, but I would highly discourage you from that. I mean, this is so easy for people to do in most cases. There may be a few situations here and there that it's not, but in most cases, especially if you're planning for this from the beginning, it's no issue in the process.
Would one way to get to the middle be to add an unless to the end of that sentence? You know, so the easy way is the way they'll save money, but if for some reason there are constraints on the project that even despite the insurance savings, it's still more efficient to put the stuff where you want to put it, then again, people get their fair warning up front, but they still have an option.
Well, it does say designed and or elevated. So if you could prove that the way that you have it is going to provide protection, then there may be a way to not require that. But if it can be required, then if it's possible, it should be required.
Cheryl Nelson has three more questions. Are you ready?
That's cool.
Are you ready? Okay, the first one, I'm going to read all three of them, so I'm not sure who's going to answer, but you might want to write them down.
Okay.
How does the county update those or contest them? And she's talking about the FEMA floodplain maps.
Mm-hmm.
The second question is, with our aging population, contractors are installing more elevators. What conditions are in place for variances? And the third question, how much does an elevation certificate cost to the homeowner?
Okay, I can answer two of those anyway. I'll start with the elevator one because that's easy. So elevators, the way to get around it is you put your machinery at the top instead of at the bottom. So the thing here is that you don't have a pit where all your elevator machinery is below the bottom floor, it's just somewhere else. So it doesn't really, it's just a design consideration. For updating maps, that's a way more complicated question. There is a process that homeowners can go through on their own if they feel that the current maps are incorrect, especially if they have high ground that is incorrectly shown on the floodplain. FEMA calls that inadvertently included in the floodplain, and your natural ground is higher than what FEMA identified it as being. There's a process you just go through with the surveyor for that. If you actually want to do a new study, because, for example, in most of Chelan County, the maps are from 1981, so there hasn't been a study for decades. the county can do that. It costs a lot of money, and they have to follow the FEMA process. Or you just keep calling FEMA and reminding them that you really need your maps updated, and they'll come when they come. It takes a really long time to update maps.
There was a FEMA map revision up number one or number two canyon, but it was, gosh, 20 years ago?
The newest maps in Chelan County are in the Kashmir area from east of Leavenworth to just west of Kashmir from, 2004, I think. I can't remember, but so those ones were about 20 years ago, and those are updated maps. But then there may be other areas I'm not familiar with updating one of the canyons, but sometimes they are updated here and there, especially if there's a special study done on a breach of a river or a creek or a drainage. You can do what's called a map revision and just revise a portion of the map. That's if people are going to do a lot of in a development, do a lot of alterations in the floodplain, so bring in a lot of fill or just really change the layout of the existing terrain, they may be required to do a map revision. The third question was about elevation certificate costs, and I don't know the answer to that. It depends on the surveyor that you use.
I can help with that a little bit, Mr. Chairman.
You were ready at the end.
Well, I've done hundreds, maybe thousands of elevation certificates over the course of my career, and they vary wildly. If there is a base flood elevation established in the insurance rate maps, then it's fairly easy in most cases. But a lot of the flood zones, particularly Zone A, there is no base flood elevation prescribed, so that has to be calculated. So you have to hire a hydrologist to analyze the drainage basin, look at how much water is generated in a 100-year storm event, and they calculate that. You have to have topography of the entire basin to determine that, so that can get easily $20,000 to $25,000 to do that if there's no designated base flood elevation on the flood insurance rate maps. So it varies wildly, and it can be a lot of money.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, and let me add, there also are some flood zones where the landowner can fill out the elevation certificate. So not all of them require a surveyor.
Cheryl Nelson also added, this would add additional cost to homeowners, increasing the cost of the base price of homes in Chelan County.
So an elevation certificate is a requirement in order to get flood insurance. And flood insurance is a requirement of a federally backed mortgage. And so that's why elevation certificates are a base requirement of the FEMA federal regulations. So the county has to require them at the end of, at least the final elevation certificate at the end of the process. But we can show you some really good examples of where elevation certificates that are provided at the beginning of the process can really help the houses be built in compliance. And if you, that's very important. Houses that are built in compliant with FEMA regulations have low flood insurance rates. Houses that are not compliant have really high flood insurance rates, and FEMA may come and make you fix what you didn't build correctly. So that's why it's really important for the county to really review and regulate these according to code, because if a home gets built not to these floodplain regulations, there can be some problems in the future.
Is there any further comments or questions from the public? As
Hearing none and seeing none, we close the portion of public questioning testimony and bring it back to the planning commission to see if there's any further discussion.
This is Greg Becker. I have one last question. When FEMA puts all these rules together, is there any consideration that for the Columbia River, which water levels are highly regulated by all the dams we have on here, is there any consideration for that control in these rules or regulations?
Yes, there are. It's, there's usually on controlled water courses like the Columbia River lakes or on other dammed lakes. Usually the flood elevation would be the spillway elevation. And sometimes that's not reflected on the maps properly, but when they do updates, then they fix those. Because back in 1981, they didn't have good elevation data, and I found that there's a lot of inaccuracies around lakes and other stuff that have a controlled elevation.
Well, I know here in Indiana, we've got some areas that are designated floodways, and we're all looking at each other. I'm on the planning commission with Brian, and we're all looking at each other like, well, how can this be because of the controlled water levels? And so this designation is really inappropriate. But what happens when somebody wants to build in those areas? Are they still subject to all these rules and regulations since the last mapping was done in 1981?
I have to take a look at the maps and to see specifically what you're talking about. I'm just not familiar enough with what the issue is you're talking about.
But even forgetting that it being specific for the city of Indiana, it's just that the idea that there are rules and regulations for areas that are probably really not apropos because of the regulation of the water levels by the dams. So what happens when somebody comes in to get a permit or build within what is designated as a floodway when all reality it isn't because the water levels are controlled by the dams? Then what happens? Do they still have to meet all these rules? Or how do they work with that?
Well, if you're specifically talking about the floodway, then it is more complicated, definitely more complicated. If it's just the 100-year floodplain, and they can prove that they are higher than what the water is ever going to get because of downstream controls, then there's processes that the landowners can go through in order to remove their property from the floodplain.
Along the Columbia River, they utilize the G line and K line that the dams have established.
Okay, so if an area shows on an old map that it's a floodplain, if in all reality it isn't, I hate to be Teutonic, but what is the procedure then? Because the homeowner could say, well, I'm really not within a floodplain because I'm on the Columbia River. So they just have to state that and prove that this particular rule or regulation is not applicable. Is that what we're saying?
There's an official process through FEMA. It's called a letter of map amendment. And that's what I was referring to earlier. If they are on natural grade that is higher than what was reflected on the FEMA maps, then it's a fairly easy process. It just requires some surveying and the assistance of a surveyor. If it's more complicated than that, then, or if it's fill or some other sort of situation, it can get really complicated.
Okay, so what you're saying of it is it can be really simple or it can be really complicated.
That's the whole thing about flood regulation. That's a good way to describe it.
Maybe yes, but maybe no, but maybe, right?
Yeah.
Any other comments?
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Any other comments from the planning commission?
This is Carl. Sounds like we have to put this down the road to the next meeting to see what changes have been made.
I believe so, that we would go forward with Abbott Christina update a few items that we discussed, and then a revision of that would come back to us for approval or denial.
It'd be nice to get those changes made tonight, but they sound too involved, and it should be a quick item next time around.
Did you want to add that to the May 6th agenda as an old business item since you're meeting anyway?
Yes, please. We get a motion from the body to...
Why we vote this break, but I vote that we refer this topic as old business to our next meeting, so in order to, the document that we receive will reflect the changes as discussed in tonight's meeting.
Second.
Sorry, who made the motion?
Greg.
Greg, and who second?
Jordan.
Jordan.
I think it will remain open, correct?
I'm sorry?
Correct.
What was the question from Jordan again?
Just was confirming that the hearing will remain open until the next meeting.
That is correct. Thank you.
Move on to next item of business.
Sorry, do we need a vote?
Oh, sorry. Yes, we do need a full vote.
This is awkward.
So we got a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Are there any nays? Motion passes to move. Let's jump to this following meeting that we're going to have in 2 weeks. Thank you. So let's move on to under new business, item B, study session for short-term rentals. Turn it over to staff.
Thank you. We have Lisa here from Burke Consulting. And she is going to, Lisa, are you able to share your screen?
Yes.
Okay, so she's going to be sharing her screen and going through a PowerPoint presentation.
Are you seeing the PowerPoint?
Yes.
Lisa Greer, I'm a principal with Burke Consulting, and I do land use and environmental planning. I'm under contract with Chelan County to help develop short-term rental regulations, so I'll walk through a PowerPoint. Are you seeing a slide that says goals for study session?
Yes.
There we go. So what I'll share is just some background on the purpose and process put to date. The board saw a version of this presentation at the end of March, gave some initial direction that we'll share with you. And based on their initial direction, we developed first draft code. So tonight, what we're looking for is a study session from the Planning Commission is, do you have questions or suggestions that can help us do some small research or bring back some options for you so that after the study session, we can develop a draft for a public hearing before you. So in terms of the purpose, the idea is to allow for property owner income through short-term rentals while protecting the character of residential communities. and we'll show some information that, that illustrates they've been developing pretty rapidly over the last several years. We know that the Planning Commission heard and denied a code in 2019 and the board, and the board wanted to review other alternatives. And when we're referring to short-term rentals, you don't have a definition like this in your code right now, but we're referring to residential dwellings rented out for less than 30 days. I'm also making a note here that we know that the board passed a temporary resolution regarding COVID-19 and limiting the use of short-term rentals during that time, except for essential purposes. So we're not covering that. We're covering sort of like the lack of regulation of short-term rentals. So the process that's laid out in our contract the steps include first developing a situation and developing a code options in March. That's where we're at, step one. Step two, we're just starting the process of the Planning Commission for study session in April, and the idea is to have a public hearing and deliberation, the target in our proposed schedule in the contract was May. And then step three, the target was to go back to the board in June and July for their round of a work session to review our recommendations to do their own hearing and deliberation. The main point here is there is still a public hearing process to come, and tonight we're just before you to share that situation assessment and that early set of code options that's based on that board County Commissioner meeting in March. So there's still opportunity to keep it and to hear more from the public. So in terms of the background information, the county received some information from Host Compliance, and they created a map and estimated the number of short-term rentals in the county across multiple platforms. And then came up with 835 unique rental units. And they're shown in different colors for the different platforms on the map, but every dot basically is a unique rental. The graphs on the bottom are showing that most of the operators are renting up the entire homes. That's the red part of the unit circle, unit types. And very few are just partial homes. And then in terms of like the kind of units that are offered for listing, the vast majority of the listing types are single family, that's in green, and then multifamily in red. So we were able to obtain some data from a portion of the platforms, the majority of the units, through a company called AirDNA. And what we were able to do with that is get Airbnb and home away data. We were able to get it with latitude and longitude, and with data that comes with it on the kinds of units. And what that was allowing them to do was to dive a little deeper into the information. So you'll see on the far right, 2019, the number of listings as of each December, so December 2019. Was 1,308. So the difference between this data and the Host Compliance, that we have two of the platforms that represent the vast majority of units, that Host Compliance did, you know, was able to get more information across more platforms. But we're sharing this with you because we think it's representative of the overall picture, which majority of the units. So we've shared by zip code here the information about the number of short-term rentals, and you can see for the zip code covering Leavenworth, which is very large, has increased from about 59 short-term rentals listed on Airbnb and Home and Way to up to 868 as of December 2019. And then Manson also has a pretty rapid change from very few 114 to over 229 in 2019. And the ones in Manson also include about 83 units on Tribal Ground. So that just gives you a sense of change.
Oh, Lisa?
Yes.
So in there, it looks like in from 2014 to 2017, there was a fairly rapid growth. And then 2017, it started slowing down. And then 18 and 19, very little percentage of difference. Is there any data or knowledge of why that slowed down? Or
I'm just guessing here, because we helped the SIC plan also with their regulations and dove into the data. I think it's just that more and more homeowners became aware and used to home shares, and they just became more prevalent and popular across the state and assuming elsewhere in the country. So I think it's a reflection of just the popularity of offering the homes and the marketplace for it. That would be my assumption for what's happening.
Does there become a limiting factor for those markets that has been found to potentially slow it down if, just by people looking to stay in those areas? Or?
You know, I assume it's based on, you know, the attractiveness of an area for, you know, those that want to come visit for tourism purposes. But in general, what we've seen is a lot of communities that have seen that rapid rise, and a lot of units have instituted short-term rental regulations to ensure, well, we'll get into it, but, you know, there's a variety of purposes as to why you might, as a local government, want to. I'll share a little more data as well. So this chart is same zip code areas. And what it's showing is as of January 2020, so that's why the count of properties in the left column are a little different. It's the difference between which ones were active December versus January. It's similar overall totals, with Leavenworth and Manson at the high end. Compared to other zip codes. This is just showing you sort of the average number of bedrooms of the units that are offered, the average number of bookings, and LTM means last 12 months, by the way, with the problems there. So the average number of bookings in the last months, the average number of days made available, so people made their homes available for more days than booked. That's the difference there. And then we have an occupancy rate. You can see roughly close to 50%. And then there's information on what the average revenue for the homeowner that's offering the unit. And then what's the average of the published rate in dollars there. So it's another look at when we get into regulations like some communities will regulate how many days a year someone can put a rental out there, and some don't. But just we're providing some of this information in terms of size and offerings, just to give you a little more character of information. The host compliance data was similar, but it's countywide, and this just gives you more of a flavor of what's happening in the different areas.
Last I had a quick question about the average annual revenue. How's that calculated? It doesn't appear to be a direct, doesn't seem to be just doing the math on last three calls.
I'll check into it a little bit more with some of the data that came with it, but my understanding is it's the average annual revenue that an operator would have earned for the number of nights that were booked. That would be my guess.
Okay, it's not a big deal. I'm just curious if they're backing anything with Airbnb's piece of that around or something, but if you can take, well, I just did the math and I come up with over 45,000 for revenue based on 49% occupancy and an average nightly rate of 252. Just curious, it's not a super important
thing. Sure. I'm sure there's some decimal points in there too, but I'll take a closer look at the information. With the latitude and longitude, we were able to map locations and where AirDNA felt that the geographic location was too precise for privacy purposes, they would kind of move it within 500 meters. But for the most part, it's pretty accurate in terms of, you know, where you have larger clusters. What we did here was show it on top of the zoning map, so we could get a sense of where things are happening. So this is the Lake Wenatchee area. And then we have Leavenworth and Shaston. And by the way, this is showing just the unincorporated areas, not what's happening in the city limits. So that's why you'll see, like in Leavenworth, there's in the middle there, there's no red dots. That's not because they don't exist. It's because we're not showing that. We're trying to show what's under county jurisdiction. And here's the Manson and Chelan area. We were noticing in the Chelan area that because there's a lot of jogs in the city limits on the north side of the lake, for example, it may make a difference on that 500 foot meter privacy technique. It may be that some of those units are in the city versus, and some that are would be in the city or the VGA just because of the irregular boundaries and the privacy that they're trying to show. But we're focused, I think, here mostly on Manson. So in addition to looking at the data, we were asked to summarize the comments that you received last year. We were given an Excel spreadsheet that summarized comments. We saw about 215 commenters. We attached that spreadsheet and to that situation assessment that's part of the packet. Between January and March, there were other comments given to the Board of County Commissioners and the Community Development Department, offering some ideas regulate short-term rentals. So we summarized the themes in that blue box there, and we were seeing some several comments around having a clear and fair process and enforcement, addressing common nuisances, noise, addressing the pressure of having too many occupants on septics and utilities, making sure there's good oversight on public health and safety, comments about avoiding too many short-term rentals, due to concerns about affordability, supply, neighborhood character. There were a range of opinions on how to address occupancy limits, having like one toll versus counting it up by based on number of people per bedrooms. There were some comments about limiting the density of short-term rentals and how many could be owned by one person or entity. And then some comments about short-term rentals being regulated like a business. After our presentation to the board, some additional comments came in, or right around the time of the presentation to the Board of County Commissioners. There are about 14 listed here between the end of March and about noon today. this afternoon, we got another four more similar comments to what we were seeing at that blue box on the prior page. With some being concerned about setting density limits, avoiding having them in some zones like the Shaston residential zones, operators wanting to make sure there were fair rules and concerned about occupancy limits. Some wanted to avoid having a hearing during, you know, the COVID crisis and wanting to weigh in when different aspects of the draft code. So So I believe staff has put together a PDF of the comments that are listed here, as well as the ones that came in after this afternoon. And those are being transmitted to the Planning Commission for your review. And what we'll do is similar to the 2019 comment matrix, we'll develop a more thorough matrix and develop some responses and consider it in the draft code that works after this. So that's the summary of the community input so far. So some of the things we share in the situation assessment are what are some different approaches and options, and best practices. So you'll see here some ideas about ensuring there's clear definitions, having some kind of regular permitting and record keeping, putting in provisions that help protect the supply and affordability of housing, standards to protect guests' health and safety, standards to help protect neighborhood character for neighbors, and ensuring that short-term rentals are treated similar to other accommodations and pay the appropriate taxes. So when we shared this with the board in late March, some of the direction we received at that time were to have some limitations on the where allowed and how many are allowed. And so the suggestion was to have a 1% cap on new short-term rentals. So what we were discussing at that meeting was if post-compliance's number is the most accurate as of March, the 1500 number, that would be another 15, roughly, off of that basis. And also to consider limiting the number in some areas that were particularly high density, like in the Leavenworth area, that zip code that has the greatest number over 800 that we were looking at earlier. And their thought at the time was grandfathering existing short-term rentals but not allowing new ones. I believe in our issue paper situation assessment, that zip code with Leavenworth and Lake Wenatchee was over 12% short-term, of units were being used as short-term rentals, and the share of new short-term rentals compared to new construction short-term rentals far above that. So that was the rationale there. But aside from having an overlay for limiting density, in that particular area, they were suggesting that the rest of the rules, like on how you operate a short-term rental, would be countified. They also suggested that we allow short-term rentals within either the primary residence or the accessory dwelling unit, but not both. That a short-term rental permit not be transferable to a new owner. A new owner would be able to apply, like everybody else. The occupancy be capped at 10, and to make compliance easy, the number of bedrooms or sleeping units that the advertised would be used to help determine that. They also wanted to see for health and safety, following the building code, health district standards, fire codes, having someone, a manager, within 30 to 45 minutes to respond to questions or complaints, and having a fire protection plan and standards that address noise, garbage, and trespass. And they also wanted to see a permit, a land use permit, and inspections and provisions for enforcement. So they were looking at an annual permit. The first permit would have inspections by the fire district or fire marshal and the health district as appropriate. And then after that, there would be like a self-certification process that enforcement would follow the county's typical process, except for where the state law has some standards. And then if there were citations for violations, they would be given to the short-term rental owner.
Is there an idea what that permit would look like?
What do you mean in terms of what it would look like? The cost or the time or?
All of the above.
So we haven't calculated a cost, I think, in some of the draft material from some of the commissioners. They were talking about a $500 fee for the first permit, the first one. But basically what they wanted was a fee that recouped the cost of the reviewing inspections. So we are planning to take a look at the county's time for review and come back to you with an estimate based on what the department, the community development department needs, what fire inspections would look like, what health inspections would look like. The self-certification would be lower because it's really more rote at that point. They're agreeing that they keep meeting the standards that are in the code and there doesn't need to be new inspections and that sort of thing. And then we do have later in the presentation an idea of how a permit process would work if you were to go with this 1% cap idea.
Who reviews that permit?
The Community Development Department would review it. And then the Health District would have to be involved. But I believe, the Community Development Department coordinates the permit reviews with other agencies. So it would be coordinated through Community Development.
Yes.
I have a question.
This is a great record. You know, we can make all the rules and regulations that we want, but unless we've got provisions for ongoing enforcement, and we're only fooling ourselves to think that all of these rules and regulations are going to be met. What provisions have been made or being proposed to cover the cost of ongoing enforcement? And also follow-up enforcement or dealing with the cost of addressing complaints?
I think I would have to interface a bit with the prosecuting attorney's office when they reviewed our situation assessment. It was my understanding that whereas the permit fee covers the cost of the permit review and inspection, that permit fee is not supposed to cover the enforcement costs. And I think that happens separately. And that's where we need a little more conversation with that office to get a handle on how are the costs for enforcement addressed through the county's Title 16 process.
And okay, if I can just interject, effective January 1st, that's our target date. Code enforcement in Chelan County will actually be handled through the Sheriff's Office, and we are going to be revising Title 16 to be a citation-based code. And so the fees from the citations would presumably handle the enforcement of that. However, that needs to be part of the discussion in Title 16 and with our prosecuting attorney also.
This is Carl Blum. Deanna, just to clarify, you said that you're planning or hoping to get the code enforcement that's in community development now will go to the Sheriff's Department. Is that what I understood?
That is part of the reorganization plan that's been approved by the county commissioners, yes. And the reason it's effective tentatively January 1st is because Title 16 needs to be rewritten to make it a citation-based code. But yes, it is going to the Sheriff's Office.
And the Sheriff is on board with that?
Absolutely.
So we do have here on the screen an outline of how we're organizing the amendments. And one section you'll see on the bottom right is we have a subsection of Title 16 for enforcement and violations. So we're trying to build off the county's code, and when that gets updated, that section can be part of that update. But in terms of the basics, we start with the use allowances, so which zones would short-term rentals be allowed, and then there's a section in 1188 where you have supplementary provisions and accessory uses, and that's where there would be a new subsection that has all of those standards around what must be met in order to operate short-term rentals. So we were talking about parking, having a fire management plan, all that stuff, all those standards would be in there. Then for definitions, we would have new definitions of short-term rentals, short-term rental operator, short-term rental owner. We will be coming back to you with some additional work on definitions. We focused on these first ones, but there needs to be some additional work on definitions. The building officials identified a couple of things, and then I think you have a lot of other definitions for similar things like beds and breakfast, and so we want to make sure it's really clear how this fits in to that range of definitions. So on the following slides, I'm going to take major sections and highlight what we were proposing to respond to the board direction.
This is Carl.
Sure.
Can I ask, who is the author of this draft?
So I authored the draft as a first cut, trying to respond to what I was hearing for direction from that late March meeting.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. So for the zones allowed, on the left-hand side, in rural and resource zones, it would be permitted in the rural residential, rural recreational, rural village, rural commercial, conditional use permit in the resource zones, so the commercial ag, commercial forest, and commercial mining, and prohibited in the industrial, rural industrial, and rural public. In the Manson UGA, we're keeping the use allowances the same. Where the residential zones, it's accessory, and also in the CD zone, and still prohibited in the other public and light industrial zone. And then in Peshawston, showing it as permitted in the residential, accessory in CB and CH, and prohibited in the industrial public use. It's basically very similar to the Manson one, but even though we're saying permitted, there's a lot of limitations that I'll go over that would limit the ability to do it in some areas like Manson and Shasta and the Leavenworth Code. So the limitations for the annual would include a one app. And then no new short-term rentals in the Leavenworth Lake Wenatchee overlay. And we're suggesting a boundary of the zip code. We gave you a bunch of different options for how to look at a boundary. So before, the county commissioners wanted to look at an overlay in areas that were particularly having a quite a density of short-term rentals. So we're adjusting the zip code because we make permit facilitation easier because the application would have to have a zip code, and then you'd know right away in community development it's in an area where no new ones are happening. But there's other options, and so we gave you a number of different maps. There's census tract, but it's pretty similar to the zip code, a little bit of difference on the east side. And then if you wanted to kind of fine-tune the boundary, we show the watershed sub-basin boundaries because they're just a smaller unit of geography. The other place where we're suggesting no new short-term rentals is in the UGAs for Pajasta and Manson. And then also in the UGAs assigned to the cities. And the reason there was trying to avoid non-conformities when in the future they may annex to those cities and the cities would have different rules. So, and also in those areas, Manson and Chelan UGA, for example, in Leavenworth UGA, there's a lot, there's a higher density. So one of the things that you could consider is whether after a period of time when the share of those short-term rentals comes down a bit, just naturally over time with existing ones not reopening with a permit, that after a period of time you could allow for new ones under that cap, so there'd still be a 1% cap, but if the share came down, let's say the level of Lake Wenatchee zip code, then you might start allowing them. So I highlighted the places where we were suggesting this could be an area of input. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. You'll see in the draft code that some notes, that some comments that came in from the public were suggesting that the percentage be 5%. So once it got to 5% as a share of total units, then allow them again. We gave you some information from Oregon that did a study of a number of communities and what came out of that process. And the number of years is open for discussion. It could just be based on when you hit a new threshold. So that's just some food for thought on, while yes, there's some permitted zones, there's a lot of trying to shape where they're allowed and limits on density. And then there's a section on standards that covers all these different subjects that the unit be either the primary or accessory dwelling unit, but not both. There was direction from the board to consider limits on occupancy, so up to 10, but night and day, and you'll see some comments from the public on appreciating that occupancy number, or those that are operators thinking that might be too strict, and some having questions on how the daytime occupancy works versus night. Requiring one additional spot in addition to what's already required. Making sure that the county's garbage regulations are followed and that solid waste is collected. Meeting the county's noise ordinances. Avoiding trespass. Providing for signage so people know who to contact. Whoever's in the unit. Following consumer safety provisions, that's particularly the state law that was passed, so we're referring to that. Meeting fire safety and outdoor burning standards, ensuring a qualified person is able to respond. The board said 30 to 45 minutes, we put in 30 minutes, that's certainly up for discussion. Having a property management plan, ensuring the annual permit number shows up in the advertisements, requiring that the operators follow good neighbor guidelines, and that would be part of that self-certification in the future. Ensuring they carry liability insurance, and that I think is also similar to the state law, and also similar to state law paying the applicable state and local taxes. So that would be the standards section. And then in terms of how would a permit process work when you have a 1% cap and it's based on the number that you have. So, and you also have quite a number right now. You have 1,500 according to host compliance. So how does this work? So we suggested for a first cut this spot here So again, first permit, we'd have fire and safety and house inspections, and then there'd be an annual renewal through self-certification. But how would you determine the number? So we were thinking an annual renewal could be in the fall, so those that have existing units would apply. And the county would, you know, they would apply September and October, and the county could review November for January, and then by February 1st, the county would report the baseline number of existing short-term rentals, and then that would give you how many new ones would be allowed with the 1% cap. And then from, you know, a couple weeks after that number is announced, then a few months for new ones to submit new applications, and then they would be accepted on a first-come, first-served basis up to that percentage cap. So that was back to, I think, an earlier question of the chair, how this was worked. That was based on the board direction to have a cap, and the cap be based on the number of units. We're trying to establish a way to determine what that is. Also, given the number of units today and the number of potential renewals, allowing enough time for operators to apply and for the county to review. That was the thought.
So with that, basically the permit is open for anyone to apply for it if there's X amount of availabilities for that number of usage in that area. And it's a first come, first basis, so there's no really, there's no weeding anyone out. You're just, you apply, you get it?
Well, it's first come, first, the details on the first cut of the draft are first come, first served that are compliant, right? So you just go down the list in order that they were submitted, and if they comply, then they're counted towards the new ones. If someone doesn't comply, you know, then you move to the next.
And the compliance is fire safety and health inspection?
Well, also those other standards that I was summarizing, that they just prepared, like a fire management plan, and property management plan, and designated someone to respond to the principal.
30 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, all that stuff. So the self-certification form would take a lot of that and just have a checklist, and after your first permit, then you would self-certify that you meet those standards. And that's similar to that.
Would you anticipate everyone would just self-evaluate that they're in compliance at all times?
For the renewal, but then that's what you can enforce against, right? So if someone says if they've made a misrepresentation on their annual renewal and there's a complaint, then that would come back to enforcement. But it's a process that several jurisdictions are using, and City of Chelan is one of those that put that in. So
how does it work for them today,
Well, they just had their first permits, because they've only adopted in the last year, so they have they're in the first stage. And some of the jurisdictions like Bend, Oregon, had this self-certification, and apparently it's working well. There's other jurisdictions that do it too. It's a way to recognize that if you've proven with your first permit that you meet all these requirements and you're operating within those parameters, and you submit, for your annual renewal, it's recognizing, that you were inspected to begin with, and now you're keeping on meeting those standards. And again, if somebody complains and they're found to not be following it, then you can enforce.
So this is George McDevitt. I have a question about how practically the first come, first serve concept works. If there's, one day a year that there are new permits available, is there a line at the door? Is it whoever postmarks earlier? Have you seen how other jurisdictions have handled that?
Well, where I've seen this put into use is when some jurisdictions will limit density by saying you can only have short-term rentals 100 feet apart or 500 feet apart, some distance apart. And so what they'll do is they'll do a lottery to begin with, and whoever's compliant gets to set the points that are approved, and then anybody within that 400-foot radius is now non-conforming. And so that's very complex, but some jurisdictions have put that into place. And what they're saying is basically you get a lottery number, and if you meet all the standards, you're approved.
This is Carl Blum. I have to agree though with Jordan. The first come, first serve is just, it puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the applicants and on the community development staff. There's going to be a lot of boxes of chocolates and flowers being thrown at them, as well as a long line out the door. And even without the type of density control you were just talking about, within 500 feet or whatever, just the way it's written now, it could very easily be just a straight lottery process. And so it doesn't matter whether you submit your application at the beginning of the period or at the end of the period, you get the equal chance to everybody, and then you don't have a rush at the door, you don't have pressure on the people receiving the applications. I think that really needs to be considered.
Okay, well, we can certainly share some additional examples of the lottery approach, and our thought was to give enough time for people to apply, but we'll bring back some of those options for you.
Yeah, a lottery. Go ahead, Greg.
I was just going to say, I am still concerned about a citation-based form of revenue for enforcement, because that's assuming that you've got sufficient amount of manpower to respond to the complaints to write the citations. And I'm not sure that we're even at that point where we've got the manpower to respond to the complaints. I know that in the testimony that we received, there were people that had said that they had called the sheriff's department, and sometimes they would show up, or they would show up, you know, extremely late. The situation that they complained about had changed, and so there was no opportunity for enforcement or a citation written. I still don't understand why. I know in the 27 ideas that I submitted back whenever, that why we can't have an enforcement surcharge of some form that's paid by the applicants, that we create a pool for enforcement, and therefore, if necessary, we have money there to hire additional bodies for enforcement, not clog up the sheriff's department, and in turn have a better opportunity in order to enforce all the rules that we're proposing that go into effect. And I don't know if other communities do that as far as some kind of a surcharge. But I really, really wonder whether or not an enforcement-based form of revenue is going to be sufficient.
Can I answer that question, Lisa?
Yes, please.
So I think that the design in going to the sheriff's office is not really to create a revenue stream based on enforcement. Obviously, our first visit isn't to write a citation, it's to gain compliance. And that's what we really want, is voluntary compliance. There are other mechanisms besides citations that we need to be looking at in this code. And that is also the opportunity after a certain number of visits or complaints or whatnot, that the permit itself may be at risk. So it's not just that somebody could continue operating in violation and be racking up all of these citations. That's really not an effective form of enforcement either for the neighborhood or the short-term rental. So it is another avenue we're going to have to look at in this.
And haven't we heard that the county doesn't necessarily have the legal authority to charge for enforcement?
That's why we're going to a citation-based code. The code as it is right now does not allow for that. We have to go through the courts.
Thank you.
So one thing that I wanted to point out on enforcement is that in the Department of Revenue state law that was passed last year, there's a section that the notice of a first violation for consumer safety, and that's things like, do you have smoke detectors? And there's a few other things, but it's basic health and safety for tenants. That the notice of first violation has to be sent by the county attorney, and there's a civil fine that's in the state law. It also looks like the state law refers to other parts of this state law that allows for the county to have a civil enforcement process. And so I think there's some flexibility there, and we just need to keep working with the prosecuting attorney's office on the best way to represent it. But our thought was, like Anna said, Title 16 follows a voluntary compliance process to begin with. And there's steps and procedures already built in there, so to the extent we can, that's what we're building off of. And so there'd be that subsection that would have just a few things related to short-term rentals, like this reference to the state law, and the ability for the county to revoke land use permits if there's if they haven't renewed. You know, if they've missed their annual renewals and they're not self-certifying and they're not voluntarily compliant with that. If there's materials, misstatements on their application forms and there's multiple violations and that sort of thing.
But there still has to be the budget for the manpower to see that all the requirements are being met and to respond to the complaints. Are we saying that there is a sufficient amount of money anticipating 1,500 vacation rentals and the amount of complaints that we receive from people about nearby vacation rentals? Are we saying that there is indeed enough money in there to respond to the complaints and to enforce these codes, that it will cover whether we don't write the citation initially, but do we even have the money to just point out and encourage and point out violations? Is the money there to adequately respond in order to erase the fears of the people in the community?
So, Deanna, I think in the restructuring that there's been some thought in terms of like, does the county need in order to have, you know, code enforcement in general, and then I think we could work with the prosecuting attorney's office on what is the best approach, and then pose these questions. And we can also maybe do a little bit of case study on other counties on, you know, what how many FTEs or, you know, how they handle, you know, enforcement, and maybe between those two things we can, you know, bring back more information for the commission.
Yes, and I would anticipate this not being, so for example, if we have three full-time enforcement officers out of the sheriff's office, they're also going to be doing other duties. So that's a really good question on how do we fund the enforcement, but we're not fully funding enforcement based on just the fees that we're bringing in with the short-term rental. So, great question. We're gonna have to have more discussions about that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Greg, it seems to me, based on what Deanna said, that this is still an outstanding question to be determined. And it seems to me when they sort out all of code enforcement going to the sheriff's department, then we're going to have the answer as to, is there enough people, are they going to have enough money, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, obviously, and there's always a concern because of what's happened to the economy. you know, are the anticipated revenues coming into the county, which would obviously cover this aspect of code enforcement. How much is that going to be reduced because the money's not going to be coming in as initially anticipated, whether it's from REIT or these other things. And it just, I just want to make sure that we don't just have a whole series of rules and regulations, and it turns out, once again, we really don't have the manpower to enforce them. So what good are they? So I hate to be Teutonic, but that's just the way my mind works.
There's another question, Lisa.
Oh, okay.
Vicki, will you scroll a little bit back? She had two questions. I was waiting for the appropriate time to ask the first one, but I think we passed it. She said, this is Vicki Malloy. Has any, excuse me, I do not have the coronavirus. I was just choking. Have any considerations been made towards having a lodge category for those units that were built to accommodate larger groups? And then her second question is, we're scrolling down here. I know that the county plans to provide FTEs and funding for additional officers to meet the needs of the STR complaints. She was just commenting on that one. So back to her first question about the lodge.
So example I was taking a look at is City of Spokane, and they have sort of two levels of permits for short-term rentals. One that's the basic short-term rental, and another for a conditional use permit when the short-term rental includes commercial meetings. And they define that more broadly. It could be a nonprofit, or it could be a for-profit, but a space that's designed for retreat type thing. And so they just have more rules and limitations on having a conditional use permit for those. So that might be a way to address it. And I think also it's our intent to work with the building official, with community development staff and prosecuting attorney, getting our definitions in order. Because we have bed and breakfast, we have guest house, there's boarding house that's not defined, and then there's lodging. So there's a lot of different related and sort of related terms that we need to clean up.
This is Jordan McDevitt. I really like the idea of the concept of a tiered series of permits where if somebody's renting out one room in their house that's otherwise the primary residence is going to have a different impact than renting out a whole house to a group of 12 people with no owner present. You know, is there a category for the really small ones that don't seem to be causing lots of problems and the really big ones and something in the middle? I mean, complexity is never a great thing to add, but it would be really interesting to see if other jurisdictions have done that.
Yes, some have. So mostly the ones I was looking at in Oregon, they have like different levels of permits. So like it's easier to get a permit to do 15 days a year because the idea is, you know, the owner's mostly there except for those 15 days. And then they have, if you're doing more than so many days, more than 90 usually or something like that, then they might have a stricter permit process. Some jurisdictions will not allow for short-term rentals that are not the primary residence, or they might say it's you can do only two, and one of them has to be the primary residence. You can have one other one that's not. So there's a wide range of ways that jurisdictions have addressed it.
I'm just thinking about the sort of the complaints we've received. Very few of them seem to be coming from the small owner-occupied Airbnb. And they don't have the same kind of impact on affordable housing, I don't think.
If the commission wants to see options, we can bring that back.
Sounds very reasonable.
me chime in here. I agree with all that. Everyone today got another email, I think, with several attachments. And the first attachment was a list of questions. And I'm the author of those questions. I didn't realize that just the questions would go out. But those are questions that I have to the author, which I guess is you, Lisa. And I don't know if we want to continue this now or if we want to go down the road, Ryan, with another study session later on. We've already been at it for two hours and 15 minutes.
I believe we'll have another session in a month from now to continue this, as I obviously will not finish resolving what we're going through tonight.
Yeah, I agree. The only thing I'd like to say to Lisa and to everyone, actually, is in the past iteration of the code, Kirsten had included the requirement for a landline that was reportable to in the 911 database. And I absolutely think that must be a requirement. There are many places in Chelan County where they cannot triangulate even the cell phones because there aren't enough towers. And a young person may not know where they're at. They can call 911 but on the cell phone, but and ask where they're at, they'll say, it's a lake or whatever. So I really have to say, I just almost insist that has to be in the code somewhere.
Well, we're planning to go through all the comments and then try to respond and shape a code. I think hearing your thoughts on sort of the things that are of most concern are really helpful. So maybe we should talk a little bit about the schedule. And Deanna can help me here.
Yep.
In terms of the intent, but the general idea was in our contract, we have a draft schedule. Each step depends on the prior one. So these are the dates that were in that schedule. So tonight, a study session, and then tentatively, a special session for a hearing in mid-May, and then deliberations in late May, and then going to the board in June and July. And so, Dan, do you have a sense? I know you were still investigating this question. You said a special meeting on the 6th, which is too soon for us because it seems like there's more discussion. Do you have a sense of the schedule, or do we need to get back to the
Board?
I
actually haven't had any discussions with the board, but I think, so the board work session on June 9th, it's a workshop, and then the hearing scheduled for the 30th. So the planning commission meeting or planning commission hearing would have to be by the end of, by the end of May to schedule that. But we're running into May, so if you, I guess the planning commission members are gonna also have to decide how often they want to meet, because you can continue this discussion, the study session, to the 13th and then turn around on the 20th at your regular session and have the hearing, but we're gonna run into noticing issues. So is your regular scheduled meeting for Planning Commission on the 27th, is it the last Wednesday or is it the third Wednesday?
It appears to be the fourth Wednesday.
Which would be the 27th. Which would be the 27th, so.
It typically been on the third Wednesday, I believe.
Okay, well.
Fourth Wednesday, I believe.
Was that that?
I believe isn't it always on the fourth Wednesday of the month?
Is it the fourth, maybe?
Okay.
I think it's on the website. The website says the fourth Wednesday.
27th. You actually can still stick to this. Well, you can't. If you're going to postpone the... So basically what they're saying is you hold the hearing on the 13th and keep the hearing open, close public testimony, and keep the hearing open until the 27th, where you would deliberate and formulate your recommendation on that date. So that may need to be pushed back a little ways. I can address this with the board on Tuesday. I'm just trying to figure out a way to stick to this schedule if we need one more study session.
I don't see that happening with the material that we're going to cover in the next section that we're going to do on the 13th.
Right.
Just from my perspective, we're a long ways from a hearing. I feel like the conversation, I mean, this was the initial blush, but we didn't even really get into anything.
Okay, and I think the goal of the Board of County Commissioners is to have a hearing and get some regulations in place sooner rather than later. And I think it'll probably be fine as long as we are moving ahead and not having the study sessions and the meetings a month apart. If we can speed that up a little bit is what they're looking for.
I'm willing to meet more than once a month.
So, yeah, we can, whoops. So the 13th to continue. So Vicki Malloy was suggesting you're already meeting on the May 6th date, so continuing this workshop or study session to the 13th. And then moving the hearing to the 27th. Which would move the BOCC forward. Uh-oh, we just lost our list. You know, it's up to you. If you are available to continue this study session to the 13th, and we can just explain that to the board and go from there.
One other option is unless the agenda is very full on May 6th, we could put this item on May 6th.
The agenda on May 6th, one of the reasons we needed to postpone the text amendments was because there's a slug of them.
Okay.
There's a lot of those that's, it would be difficult to put that on an agenda with something else, especially you're probably gonna have another couple hours once you review the documents. Another couple hours of deliberation and discussion just in the workshop setting for this.
Okay.
So is the 13th was the suggested date by Vicki Malloy to continue this to.
Is there any objections to that amongst the Planning Commission?
Then that would push the actual hearing on the proposed code to when, 27th?
If you completed all of your workshop materials by the 13th, then yes, we would then push the hearing to the 27th.
So does that give everyone enough time if we have agree on recommended changes on the 13th, will that be able to be done and published in a timely manner for a hearing on the 27th?
Lisa?
So Deanna, I have to refresh my memory on if you have, is it a 10-day notice?
I knew you were gonna ask that. I don't have them in front of me. And I'm thinking that I'm looking at the dates there, study session, hearing. I'm thinking it might be a 14 or 15 day because I'm just looking at the study session and the proposed hearing dates previously. It would be tight.
Is there a reason that we can't go to the Board of Commissioners and tell them that this has got to be moved down the road a bit?
No, I think you have every right to do that and suggest that. And I'm happy to do that at the meeting on Tuesday, or actually it might help if your chairman Kelso is on the Board of County Commissioner meeting 10:15 on Tuesday to do that. I always like to say, if you had time to do something twice, you had time to do it right the first time. So if you want to take a little bit more time, I would hope that the commissioners would understand how important that is.
Well, Ryan, I think we need to do that. It's not only fair to us, but it's fair to the people working the code like Lisa, and it's fair to the people in the community that want to see what's being proposed and have time to digest it.
I can definitely talk with the Board of County Commissioners on Tuesday.
Well, I would think too, this is Greg Becker, I would think too that if we have any history, we know what kind of response potentially we're going to get on any proposal and the amount of comments and input that we're going to receive from the public, both pro and against, is going to be probably, once again, somewhat overwhelming. And we're better off doing it slowly and correctly instead of trying to rush something together where nobody ends up being happy.
I agree completely.
I agree too. I think especially when we're meeting in this sort of context, it's just not as productive, and it doesn't feel quite transparent, and there's so little interaction with the public. It makes sense that it's going to take longer to make sure we think about it thoroughly and
I did have some comments earlier, and I will relay this to you, but I think it's a really important thing to think about, is that when you get down to, it's one thing to have a workshop in this format, but when you're looking at a public hearing, it is really important with the sheer number of people that are interested in this on both sides of this issue. It's really important that there is an opportunity for each of them to be present. So I think the public is looking for a hearing date down the road when it is safe for us to publicly assemble in one location to take that public testimony.
Yes, I think that's important.
I'm in complete agreement. Yes, definitely.
So I'll work with Deanna on some options for the schedule that she can share on Tuesday, if that works for you, Deanna.
Yes, did the Planning Commission want to continue this study session to the 13th?
Yes.
Yes, I agree.
Yes.
At 7 p.m.?
That's
yes.
Yes.
Yeah, this is Carl Blum. I move that we take up the workshop again on the meeting plan for the 13th instead of a hearing.
Is there a second?
Greg Becker.
So there's a first, second. All of those in favor for having a continuation of this workshop for May 13th at 7 p.m. Say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Are there any nays? We will continue this workshop on May 13th at 7 p.m. Hopefully in person.
Based on what I was hearing so far, we need to do some additional research on code enforcement and how that would work in phase. And then I was hearing some ideas about tiering the permits for those that are owner-occupied or non-owner-occupied and those that have meeting spaces.
I think those are the main things I was.
I got one other one. Has there been any financial analysis on any of the this permit money and stuff that's coming in? Because we're, as the department, is just to use the money within itself to regulate those elements on their own and not generate or require money from elsewhere.
So one of the things we will work on is getting a sense of how much time for the first permit by staff and the inspections, so that when we say here's the suggested permit fee, it's based on
reality.
Yeah, well, that it's idea of covering the costs. Kirsten and I had started to discuss what that would be like, but we hadn't completed that thought yet, so we'll do that.
Thank you.
Lisa, one other thing we discussed was the idea of a lottery instead of a first come, first serve.
Right, yes.
And then I also just wanted to say thank you so much for all your work. I mean, we wanted some data like this on the last go around, and it's just so nice to have it. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I have an idea. Why don't you write a letter to the governor and tell him to drop this ban so we can get back to normal?
Because I have so much power. You know, my kids don't even listen to me. I don't think the governor's going to.
I have a question for Deanna.
Yes.
This is Carl Blum. Did I take it from one of the attachments that Kirsten is not working for us anymore?
Correct. Friday was her last day, so Kirsten is no longer with Chelan County.
Is there what was she, senior planner?
She was a planning manager.
Do we have one of those yet?
No, we actually have eliminated both planning manager positions, and we are currently recruiting for an assistant director that will be filling my shoes and probably taking over this process once I exit stage left.
Okay, and wasn't today the 22nd the first day of the new guy?
Tomorrow morning. He will be here tomorrow morning.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other items amongst the Planning Commission? Yes. Hearing none, I would take a motion for adjournment.
Motion to be adjourned.
Is there a second?
Second.
Oops. What happened?
Turned off.
Oh, sorry, our screen shut off real quick. Can you redo that?
it was Carl Blum seconded the motion.
Who was the
Jordan?
And Jordan. Okay, thank you.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks everybody.
Thank you.
Write that letter, Deanna.
In my spare time. All right, good night.
Good night, Brian.
Good night. Thank you, everyone.
Good night.
Okay. Stop recording. You can just exit off the
Oh, just up here?
Yep.
Ready?